Mr. Whittaker, Reel 8. You were telling me about the actions of the dummy battery and the one real gun in December 1940. If you'd like to carry on to the second day of the action.
Yes, the second day, they found in the morning that Fort McTurr had been evacuated. Everybody had gone. And we moved off. It eventually came into action. We could see quite clearly from where we were. The ground sloped up, and on top of this was another Italian strong point on this hill. Captain Bergin went forward. We reeled. I didn't have anything to do. I'm putting a good word in for myself here. I had nothing to do with picking lines up there. I had an easy part, either reeling out or picking up. We fixed the telephone. And I don't know why, but I don't think we had a radio or wireless, as we called it. And we couldn't get through the OP. We couldn't get any things from the OP. So various signals went out and used it up to find the fault. And in the meantime, the Italians shot at us. And they really did, they were very close. We dug a big curving slit trench into which we all got, instead of digging separate ones. I know this thing was on a big curve, so we...
So there's a curve. Where was the gun and where were the dummy guns at this point?
The dummy guns, I can't remember where they'd gone, but we were, as I say, we were actually in sight of this fort.
With the real gun?
With the real gun. The dummies did, they did try to draw fire, but the shell does mainly. It was frightening, but not particularly dangerous. Most of the Italian shells broke in half. We found lots of them. They're about 75 millimetres, and they're literally broken in half. And with it dropping in sand, all you'd feel was a bit of, there wasn't a blast. So unless you got hit, you were being shelled and you knew all about it. It was heads down and pray.
Now you couldn't fire back.
You couldn't fire back because we didn't know we could see this hill, but couldn't tell just where, you know. And they didn't fire anyway without orders. And it took us about an hour. And eventually the fault was traced to a knot where we picked the telephone line up. And the idea was you always bared the wire and tied a reef knot and covered it with tape. And they'd done it and hadn't bared one, they found one half of the joint hadn't been bared. And of course they'd gone over this, they had to go, you stuck a safety pin through the wire. And, you know, testing. Of course we lost. Anyway, we fired. We didn't fire many rounds. And got the odds down that Gary Bergin came on and said they're surrendering. And don't know whether he told us to go up, but anyway, we actually all went up to this fort, and they were still all there. And we're in time. There was a general. And we're in time to hear him declaim that he'd, which an interpreter told our people, that they'd never have surrendered if they'd had enough ammunition. And they were standing in front of piles of wood ammunition boxes. And literally, when they came out, which they did, there were thousands of them. And we got what did we got? About a platoon of guardsmen. We've got a company. I never know the difference. A company's the bigger one. We've got these few guardsmen and us. And the main thing was, we said, well, to these Italians, well, let's form up and march that way, east, and put one chap at their head and one at the back. Thousands of them. Absolutely incredible. I found out later that Captain Bergin had pinched the general's epaulettes. because they're in the regimental museum, and he got one or two other souvenirs, but it was all quite unbelievable.
What was the mood of the Italian now prisoners of war?
Look, very dejected. Some of them looked quite pleased. They mainly seemed, accepted it as their fate and marched off.
Did you get any souvenir hunting going on by yourself and the other lads?
I don't think that was the same day. I think that was more or less occupied that day. But the next day we moved. They took us, as far as we were concerned, they said that was it. We were waiting for the orders. And we got to a place, and there was a kit all laid out in rows. And we systematically went through it. I got a dagger, which is a very beautiful enameled coat of arms on the handle, which I've kept. I suppose some Germans got us in this term. The chief thing, we found a large food, store of food, tinned fruit, and condensed milk. And I'd always wanted, my mother and father had always stopped me eating condensed milk with a spoon, and there was nobody to stop us there. We found a gramophone and a pile of opera records. So for some time we had a telephone, I don't know what we had the telephone for, but I know we sat and ate tinned fruit with condensed Nestles too, it was definitely the Swiss Nestle, and listening to some very good opera records, and picking up with a black shirt. I found a beautiful black silk shirt. They tell me most of them were wearing actual black shirt, battalion, they've got the black shirt with a number of, there were quite a few Libyans or whatever. There were quite a lot of Italian black shirts, and all the lads were busy going around picking up pullovers, which were quite weapons you looked for. The thing you were looking for was the Berettas, which were a little tiny automatic about the size of your hand, 0.22. I didn't get one, I wasn't very interested anyway, but I did take one or two that had huge revolvers, about 45, which is they've got a tell about an inch. We took some of those loads of ammunition back. But there wasn't much of any, woolly hats, black woolly hats with pom poms on, they were quite popular. But to say, as far as.
And no one objected to you taking it?
We'd only got two or three officers, you see.
And they weren't objecting to you?
They weren't objecting. I think they were busy trying to find out what they were going to do, what the next thing was.
And what was the next thing?
We went home.
Being Mercer?
We turned around and went back to Mercer, where we arrived in triumph, black shirts, woolly hats, captured rifles. We were soon put in a place for those people who told us to take that bloody stuff off and look like soldiers and said, have a wash and shave, which we hadn't done for several days, and back to the things. Wasn't very amusing, had a funny consequence. Jackie Gore heard about it, our signal sergeant. He played hell with us, what the hell had he taught us and all this.
The Barani knot you've got.
The Barani knot.
Why was it called the Barani knot? Because you call it that.
We were near Sidi Barani was the only place we knew. We were in a place, we were nowhere, no man's land, it's just the desert, and this was just they just put this place on top of a bit of a rise. But Sidi Barani was near it, so we christened it the Barani knot.
And what happened about it? I mean, did Gore find out who'd done it?
Couldn't, because we didn't, as I say, I'm ducking out, because I literally didn't, I had an easy job. But it had a rather nasty consequence. The second in command, who was a regular, and it didn't really get on with Jack. He always regarded Jack with a bit of suspicion.
Sorry, the second in command of who?
Of the regiment. forgotten his name, but he, anyway, he was a major. And he put Jack on a charge. Apparently, he'd got somewhere of it. He knew all the regulations inside out. And although Jack wasn't there, he was in charge. And he got a severe reprimand for it. Now, just to add to this story, I'll put this in just so that it had a... Later, Jack and I had a good laugh. Years after the war ended, Jack told me he didn't get caught, or if he did, anyway. He got back to England, and eventually, after a year or two, he got his just deserts, and he was recommended to go to Octave, Officer Cadet Training Unit. So I think he was in Wales, he told me. And he thought he stood a really good chance, and he said he really, you know, he'd rehearsed his speeches and everything. Got himself, and he was a smart soldier, got himself dolled up to the nines. And they had a board. And apparently walked, they called, I think he was a sergeant major then, WO2. They called his name, WO, Warrant Officer Gore, marched into the room, and the chap in charge of the board was this major. It was Eddie Curley.
So he didn't get it?
Jack said, he said, I knew I hadn't got it. Yeah, it was the same. It was one of these silly things. I've got a theory about Jack and the second in command. Jack had invented, or we'd invented a thing to save using several telephones at the command post, a sort of thing with knife switches. So you could switch over, A through B, all the lot. And the first one was just a disaster. We called it, we called it the bollock dropper. And we inscribed on the, it was a massive box at first, and we put on it BD. The second one was a huge success. The signal, the signals, the Royal Corps of Sigs, who were attached to Regimental HQ, made one for us after we ironed out the things. With, you know, nicely made up. But Jack, with a, as I said before, he had a sardonic sense of humour. It said on this one, BD Mark II. And we were using this one day, and this major came along out on a manoeuvre. And he said, that's not an authorised piece of equipment, is it, Sergeant Gore? So Jack said, no, sir. I said, what's it for? And he told him, and we sat, and what? Why is it? Why do you think it's needed? Well, it saves, you know, one chap can answer a telephone and this, that, and the other. Then, of course, he said, what does BD stand for? So, of course, this, you can imagine, the signalers, we were all like this. And Jack had to confess, and bollocked officer. And he gave him a look that I'm convinced that's why Jack got had on.
Was it Major Daniel?
No, it was after or before Major Daniel. Walton, was it?
No.
He left us later, but when Major Daniel came, I think. But he was I always think that it was that, as I say, Jack, you know, I think the South Lots were never afraid of innovation. As I said, the Major Burke wanted, you know, people who could do lots of jobs. Jack Gore's signal soldier wanted people who could work anything and improve the equipment, if we could.
And who'd invented this?
Oh, Jack mainly, and some of the, you know, they got talking about this thing. It was like a little, it was like a miniature exchange where you could just, I know you pull the switches over, you see. So if you could talk to A Troop, normally you would have had two phones, you see, one to A Troop, one to B Troop, and probably one, you know, and connect them up and switch over. But this thing, if you sort of grow up, and it was quite handy.
So what happened next then? You got back, still at Mercer.
We got back, and the next job we went on, I was were put a gang on us, we went up onto the escarpment overlooking the Troon, sorted ammunition out. They brought guns and ammunition to the truckload, and we sorted it out. I understand it was going to Greece.
They just dumped it on the escarpment?
They just dumped it, and we sorted it.
By calibre?
By calibre. What it looked like, because, you know, oh, that's the same as that. A lot of small anti-aircraft guns, about 37mm, and we swear they worked, you know, just tried all the handles. Some of them didn't. If they didn't, you just chucked them on one side. One of our sergeants frightened us, he took me in charge, Staniforth, remember him, he frightened me to death. He did show later on, and I don't know if he's alive or dead, but he did actually, he cracked later on. And he showed signs of it, because he'd take ammunition to pieces. He'd take shells to pieces, you know, they had these things with like a key with, and he'd take the fuses out and use screwdrivers and things on ammunition. We kept miles away from him. If he found a new one he hadn't seen before, oh, that's interesting. We considered it the most unholy and dangerous occupation. Other thing I did there on this place, got the first intimations that maybe shouldn't say it, that Irish people were a bit different to us. We had a chap from Liverpool who'd been recently sent to us from a yeomanry regiment, and Bill Knight, and he used to regale us in the tent at night with tales of how they'd, as Indian owners, stuffed the prods. And first time I ever realised that there was this amount of feeling between the Liverpool Irish Catholics and the Protestants. Also, poor Bill, you'd only got to mention banshees, he'd cross himself and pray, as I say, but it was quite interesting, to as I say, what with people taking ammunition apart and Bill teaching us about the fighting in Liverpool. Then how long that lasted, but we spent a fair time fiddling about with this stuff. As I say, we sorted it, I don't know, people came and took it away.
Now, what's the next thing you remember then after that? That wouldn't take so long, I presume.
No, we were certainly there at Christmas, we had the enormous Christmas party. Then, if my memory serves right, we went and guided the Lifelines of Empire on the Suez Canal.
That would be in
January 1941, wasn't it?
That's right. And that was round about the Cabrit area.
We went to Cabrit first. That's at the end of one of the, is it the Great, anyway, the end of the Bitter Lakes, the southern end. The idea was, the wicked German propaganda had said they were bombing the Suez Canal, mining the Suez Canal, and had halted the shipping. And the British, we told the truth and said it was not that they hadn't, it was quite untrue. When we went down, of course, the ships that were lying one in half, just south of Ismailia, that was, I think, either in the sandbank. But the idea was, we had posts, they broke the regiment up, put them in posts along the part of the canal. They had posts, which I think were painted white or with bark taken off. And the idea was, the Germans were using Junkers 88, so they were dropping these mines from low level, and they had a parachute to stay in. And if they dropped one, you rushed out and stuck a post in, and somebody else rushed at the back of you, and they put you in line where this thing had gone down. If two posts got them, you've got the mine spotted. I was lucky. I was attached. I wasn't assigned to a post. I finished up at Cabrit at first. Nice brick buildings on a canal signal post, where we laid a very elaborate telephone wire system where every post had a phone and we checked them, you know, and you did, we had a number of signals and did duty all night long and checked it every hour when they came on moonlit nights. The thing I didn't like about that place, every morning, as we had to report from this thing to HQ, and that meant that we used not our phones, but the Suez Canal Company's phone. And the first morning I went up there, this so-so Frenchman had a little white, round pith helmet, very smart, and he wiped the phone after I used it. And even I, with my little French name, who wasn't being exactly complimentary about the English, but when he wiped the phone, I was really, dear, dear. But it was there was a ship sunk just below the place, and it turned out that was owned by the shipping company. Our Captain Slim, his father, was a director of this shipping company, and all the officers used to go and have news on board this. Not true, of course, because it's something mine. In the daytime, Wellington bombers used to fly up and down with a huge ring attached underneath, which was a magnetic ring which was supposed to explode these mines or whatever.
Did it work?
I don't think so, but it made it interesting, these things thundering up and down. And then the Royal Navy used to come up and down sweeping constantly. Little minesweepers, converted trawlers. But when the bombers did come, it was the most dangerous place I think I'd been in the whole war.
Why was that?
You all got rifles and you were told you could shoot, but only shoot when they were opposite you. But if you could imagine, everybody fired and they kept firing. And of course, when they passed, they were firing horizontally. Even the Bosphorus, a few hundred yards up the hill, fired over our heads. It was like Guy Fawkes and I, but they were using real. All you'd see, all I ever saw was a big. I never saw any mines drop because it was wider than we were. But you see a big black shape, boom, 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 and bang, and they'd be firing from all angles. My method, I used to sit at the bottom of the trench and just fire upwards just to. Oh, it was dangerous. But we did actually. What they did, we got one good spot. One of our posts did spot them. They got to a real good spot, and the Navy came up and swept it and sank the boat.
It sank the minesweeper.
And I wouldn't swear if it was true, but they. It sank quite close to a dredger near one of our posts that's done the spotting. And it may be an untrue story, but we all said the captain shouted abandon ship, and our people rushed and fetched some people off it. But the Navy weren't at all pleased, they were most embarrassed. And of course, we took the opportunity to go down and have a look. There were loads of naval people there. Of course, we were there saying, what did it do? Didn't they know it was, and we asked them all innocently. But it literally, that enormous bang. It had settled on the bottom, it wasn't entirely.
The mine?
The mine sweep had gone down, but it hadn't, there were still parts of it above water. But it was we moved to the other end of the canal afterwards, after we swapped places, because it was, the other part was. More in the wilds down towards Suez. We were lucky because we were allowed out. We got into Suez at time too, but the others had to be on the post at the night.
So where did you move to next after that period on the canal?
When that ended, we moved up to Hague, where that was when we started the secret invasion training. While we were on the canal, we saw HMS Formidable came through the aircraft, one of those we get with complete with. That was fascinating, just occupying the whole of the canal. We were told to keep in strict to no pictures, because they were having any cameras, did they? Not much.
Did they take pictures?
I did. And when I went to get them, I don't ask. The negatives have gone, haven't they? And I don't. They probably court martial me now. And I don't ask for them, of course. I took them through the windows of the tent. So, mind you, we went on this invasion, so these were coming up.
Now, this was the possibility of an invasion on roads, possibly.
Oh, you mustn't say that. It was a deadly secret. And I've since read books, and everybody knew.
Did you know at the time what it was?
Pretty well, because the description of the place we're going to, according to our geographical experts, could only be roads. And everything was done by hand. We're only going to have one gun tower and no... I don't think we're going to take lenders. All the signalling equipment had to be... We did ours with stretcher.
Now that was, again, this is another invention that it wasn't standard equipment,
no,
was it?
No, we just had to... Some of them put this stuff in packs. But we invented a stretcher with straps over your shoulders, which all we put the set in between and...
No, you'd have to carry the batteries as well, wouldn't
you?
Yes. So it would be fairly heavy.
Terrible. You're fitter than I've ever been in my life.
Now, they go on about, you used to have to run up and down a hill and all this. Did you really have to do that, or is that...
They made us, we had to, they taught us, we started off marching with these things, and we actually did trot. And we marched, we did route marches to get us fit. We passed the Durham Light Infantry one day. We passed them. And their officers had some very sharp things. They said we were trying to make fools of them and things. We weren't, of course. Not, well, you know. We did all that for physical. Instead of, we didn't do any PT. It was all done with this equipment. All carrying, everybody carried stuff.
And... Was there any other special training for roads?
We went down on the canal. We only went down just they had one barge or something there, and they but we didn't. We went down, but only to watch, just have a look at this barge that they'd got, so we know what it looked like. And I forgot what it did to tell the truth. And then we saw some come up on another ship through the canal in pieces. They said that. We did manage to drop a gun in the canal where the thing drifted away from shore.
How did that happen? Did you see that?
No, I heard whether it was, they said it had, they'd loaded it up, and there was some tide in the canal, went up at the morning and down at night, and it just drifted off slightly just as we were unloading it, so it dropped into the shallows. But to say as signalers, all we did was carry loads of stuff.
And that's as far as the roads training went, as far as you were concerned.
Yeah. But it was we didn't fancy it at all, because apparently the word went round. They said everybody, they said every German in Cairo, everybody's talking about this forthcoming invasion. And with the stuff we'd got, it was, well, I mean...
You just got your new £25, or they came at the end of it.
We got those afterwards, because that's when we went up to the roof, wasn't it? Had we just got them? We got some 25 pounders. They may have been the brand new ones.
I think they arrived just at the end of your invasion training.
Yeah. Yes, because I think we were using the old stuff at first, and then we got these. There was loads of new stuff came up. We used to see it going up the road. You know, they'd unload at Suez.